I wanted to talk about Elmer Gantry, just in by way of a book review kind of a thing. Elmer Gantry by Sinclair Lewis is one of my favorite things to read. He's such a great gas bag, such a great figure in American literature that I thought I would just kind of... some of you have read the book, and some of you may not have read, so I'd kind of like to gear this in the nature of just talking about it to hope to turn people on to read it or maybe reread it. I've got a whole bunch of things that I want to read here. I usually, when I do these things, I let the guy speak for himself as much as possible, so I probably won't be able to get to all of these. But I want to get to as many as possible and just let him speak. Sinclair Lewis is one of the few Americans to win the Nobel Prize. I think there have been, what, maybe 10, 12, if that, maybe 10 people have won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Sinclair Lewis is one of them. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Aerosmith, and he refused the prize. Every now and then somebody, for all kinds of reasons, will turn it down. Sartre turned down the Nobel Prize years ago, which carried about 50,000. I don't know if he'd turn it down today. It's up around 90,000 or more, so maybe he'd take it. That's a bit sarcastic, I guess. But I have a hard time figuring out why people would work all their lives in their profession, and then when someone wants to honor them with the highest accolade, they turn it down. It's difficult for me to see. But anyway, be that as it may. His books are full of sarcasm, so it's all right for me to start off that way. And what Sinclair Lewis does to people and to places should not be done to anybody. If you have read Main Street, you'll remember Carol Kennicott's aim. She married a country doctor and went to live in a small town. They're all around Minnesota or Ohio, all these things. Nebraska, yes. And she can't stand it because there's no programs for the disabled or the socially disenfranchised or whatever. And besides that, the flag flying over the town hall is shredded. And she can't get the boys stirred up to do anything. And she's all socially aware. And in a little town in Minnesota where the country doctor lives, they're aware of what they're aware of, and they don't care much about outside that sphere. And it drives her up a tree that she can't stir them up into doing great and mighty things. And she soon makes enemies of the whole blasted town. Every time the merchants see her coming, oh my God, here comes little Miss Do-Goods again. She wants us to do this. She wants us to give part of our store for the boys' club. And we don't want any boys' club. All our boys are working in the hardware store or taking over the old man's feed business or whatever. So in Babbitt, another favorite book of mine, he's sat around. There came a Frisbee from the top things. We've got lots of stuff going on here today. As W.C. Fields would say about children, well, I won't say.
Go over to Lois.
Yeah, send them over here. Let's see how they do.
W.C. Fields loved children, and not around him, but he loved them. He had a home near...
Very good.
He had a home near where we live in Thousand Oaks. He had a home on Lake Sherwood, which is just over the hill from where we live. And he could be seen daily coming out with his cane, whacking at the geese, and making them get off his lawn. Well, everybody else cultivates that kind of an image so they can have some ducks and geese. He would be out there whacking them and taking a nip out of his thing. Anyway, Babbitt was a real estate salesman, and Sinclair Lewis did his best to make him look bad. And Babbitt was all for zip and boom and go, and he used to have little boost buttons he wore, and he would boost this and that kind of a product, and supported the football team, and was just a funny figure. And then in Aerosmith, it's the doctors that get it. And although he's a little gentler in Aerosmith than the rest of his books. And here, of course, Elmer Gantry is the preacher. And many of you have seen the movie, Elmer Gantry. Won Burt Lancaster Academy Award for it. Tremendous performance. I've forgotten who played Sister Falconer. Was it Gene Simmons? Anybody remember?
Gene Simmons.
I think it was, yeah. The whole movie of Elmer Gantry is built around Sister Sharon Falconer, this lady evangelist. In the book, just one section of the book is devoted to Sharon Falconer. The book, you can really kind of divide it up into three parts, and interestingly enough, into three women in his life. The first one is Lulu Baines, the wife of one of the deacons of Elmer's First Parish. And the second section is Sharon Falconer, an evangelist that Elmer kind of gloms onto when he's out of work. And then the third one is Cleo Benham, the choir director in the Methodist Church. He goes from the Baptists to the Methodists, and he winds up on the way to becoming a bishop in the Methodist hierarchy. And he has a tremendously successful career, and he's the biggest gas bag in the history of preaching, and where there are several. And he's really got his act down to where he can sell himself, but his private life is a shambles, absolute wreck. And he just keeps going from, it's a great naturalistic novel from that point of view. The book opens with a line, Elmer Gantry was drunk. That's the opening line. He was eloquently drunk, lovingly and pugnaciously drunk. He leaned against the bar of the old home sample room, the most gilded and urbane saloon in Cato, Missouri, and requested the bartender to join him in the good old summertime, the waltz of the day. And Elmer is a student at a seminary, a college in Missouri or in Kansas, I guess, and where they don't drink and they don't smoke and they don't cuss and they don't chew or go with girls who do or any of those kinds of things. So naturally, the book opens with Elmer being roaring drunk, because that's what you do when you're at those kinds of colleges and seminaries. You go across the river or down to the town where you can drink. When I taught at Concordia Teachers College in Seward, Nebraska, no one drank, except at the little town 12 miles outside. And there was no dances allowed, so they danced anyway and called it synodical foot frolics, which I thought was rather stupid. And unbeknownst to me, I sponsored the first school dance in the history of Concordia and almost got fired for it. But I just assumed everyone, the kids came to see me and say, would you sponsor this dance? I said, sure, not knowing that it was against the policy to dance. And then I got, again, the dean of chapel, and I had a talk about that. I thought it was rather unclassy, though, for him to go on to the loudspeaker of, this has nothing to do with Elmer Gantry, but I never digress. But he went to the loudspeaker of a homecoming football game and announced during halftime, as the band was preparing to march in the field, there will be no dance. What you have heard is not true. Professor Ledbetter is not sponsoring a dance, and if you go to it, you'll be kicked out of school. All this in the halftime, and you can imagine the visiting school they shrieked at that, and our own kids just hung their heads. But he was right. There was no dance. There is now. There's dancing and all, and he's now working for Jack Preuss in St. Louis, and I hope having a miserable time. I can't imagine him working there and not having a miserable time. Well, enough of that. Elmer Gantry, best known to his classmates as Hellcat, had this autumn of 1902 been football captain and led the best team Terwilliger College ever had. They had won the championship of East Middle Kansas Conference, which consisted of 10 denominational colleges, all of them with buildings and presidents and chapel services and yells and colors and a standard of scholarship equal to the best high schools. But since the last night of the football season, with the glorious bonfire in which the young gentleman had burned up 9 tar barrels, the sign of the Jew tailor, and the president's tabby cat, Elmer had been tortured by boredom. And that's the introduction, or one of the introductory paragraphs to the book. And you see Sinclair Lewis puts that needle in very quickly and deftly. And he does it and then leaves, and not unlike Flaubert and Madame Bovary, only Sinclair Lewis is a heck of a lot more brutal than Flaubert was with Emma Bovary. Saying that these schools are all alike and their standards equal to the best high schools, that says it right there, and you know what kind of college we're dealing with. And of course Elmer is no scholar. He's in there because his mother wanted him to be a preacher. And his roommate is Jim Lefferts. Now Jim has great contempt for the church, and he's eloquent in his contempt, and Elmer had none of Jim's resolute contempt for the church. Elmer was afraid of it. It connoted his boyhood, his mother drained by early widowhood and drudgery, finding her only emotion in hymns and the Bible, and weeping when he failed to study his Sunday school lesson, the church full 30 dizzy feet up in its curiously carven rafters, and the preachers so overwhelming in their wallowing voices, so terrifying in their pictures of little boys who stole watermelons or indulged in biological experiments behind barns, The all-oppressed moment of his second conversion at the age of 11, when leaping with embarrassment and the prospect of losing so much fun, surrounded by solemn and whiskered adult faces, he had signed a pledge binding him to give up forever the joys of profanity, alcohol, cards, dancing, and the theater. Now, that's the kind of church that he was going into, and that's his memories of the church. But he did his best in the college, in his college years. He wasn't a good student, as I said, but he was big. He played football. He pounded people on the back, and everybody kind of liked Elmer. He had a beautiful, sonorous voice, and when he did remember this class song or a hymn and he sang, everybody said, "Gee, Elmer, you sing keen or swell." And from those great comments, he started building up little by little the idea that maybe he could become what his mother had always hoped he would become, a preacher. He had no interest in the church. He had no concept about God whatsoever, except that he was big, and people said, "Gee, Elmer, you sing swell. You would make a great preacher." And they said that so often that little by little he started believing himself that maybe he could be. He enjoyed, as Sinclair Lewis says, the church, the Sunday school, the evangelistic orgy, choir practice, raising the mortgage, the delights of funerals, the snickers in back pews or in the other rooms at weddings. They were as natural, as inescapable a mold of manners to Elmer as Catholic processionals to a street gamin in Naples. So he grew up in this kind of aura of people and going to church, and it's hot and dusty, and gathering by the river for the baptisms and having suppers, church socials, and enjoying each other's company. And throughout Sinclair Lewis's book, he introduces enough of the camaraderie of this kind of thing and enough of the getting together to make you kind of wish you were back there in Kansas or Missouri or Nebraska or Minnesota. And yet Elmer comes along just kind of swashbuckling his way through this and destroys everything. So you're not sure whether you should like it or despise it, because you're not sure whether you should like Elmer Gantry or despise him. And you wind up doing a little of both. Early in January was the annual college YMCA week of prayer. It was a countrywide event, but in Terwilliger College it was of a special power that year, because they were privileged to have with them for 3 days none other than Judson Roberts, state secretary of the YMCA, and a man great personally as well as officially. He was young, Mr. Roberts only 34, but already known throughout the land. He had always been known. He had been a member of the Star University of Chicago football team. He had played varsity baseball. He had been captain of the debating team. And at the same time, he had commanded the YMCA. He had been known as the praying fullback. He still kept up his exercise. He was said to have boxed privily with Jim Jeffries, and he had mightily increased his praying. A very friendly leader he was, and helpful. Hundreds of college men throughout Kansas called him Old Judd. Between prayer meetings at Terwilliger, Judson Roberts sat in the Bible history seminar room at a long table under a bilious map of the Holy Land and had private conferences with the men's students. A surprising number of them came edging in, trembling with averted eyes, to ask advice about a secret practice, and Old Judd seemed amazingly able to guess their trouble before they got going. "Well now, old boy, I'll tell you, terrible thing all right, but I've met quite a few cases, and you just want to buck up and take it to the Lord in prayer. Remember that he is able to help unto the uttermost. Now the first thing you want to do is get rid of, I'm afraid you have some pretty nasty pictures and maybe a juicy book hidden away, now haven't you, old boy?" How could old Judd have guessed? What a corker. "That's right, I got a swell plan, old boy. Make a study of missions and think how clean and pure and manly you'd want to be if you're going to carry the joys of Christianity to a lot of poor gazebos that are under the evil spell of Buddhism and a lot of those heathen religions. Wouldn't you want to be able to look them in the eye and shame them? Next thing to do is get a lot of exercise. Get out and run like hell. And then cold baths. Darn cold. There now." Rising with ever so manly a handshake, "Now skip along and remember," with a tremendous and fetching and virile laugh, "just run like hell." Jim and Elmer met in chapel. And that was really the beginning of Elmer's getting into the church in high gear, because he looked up to Judson Roberts, a guy who could play football and known as the fullback of prayer and all that kind of thing, the praying fullback. And that was his model. So Elmer is off and running. He's going to be preaching So he has to find something to preach, and of course he doesn't have an original thought in his mind, never does have one throughout the entire book. Almost rises to bishop in the Methodist Church and never does have an original thought, but he can read and he kind of picks things up. So he finds a book by a man named Ingersoll, and he happens upon this theme, and this becomes his stock phrase, and he preaches it at weddings and sermons at funerals and any kind of, to the gun club, the rod and gun club. Love is the only bow in life's dark cloud. It is the morning and evening star. It shines upon the cradle of the babe and sheds its radiance upon the quiet tomb. It is the mother of art, inspirer of poet, patriot and philosopher. It is the air and light of every heart, builder of every home, kindler of every fire on every hearth. It was the first to dream of immortality. It fills the world with melody, for music is the voice of love. Love is the magician, the enchanter, that changes worthless things to joy and makes right royal kings and queens of common clay. It is the perfume of the wondrous flower, and on and on and on. And that appeals to him. So when he gives his first chapter, and that's really nice words, it'd be kind of hard to fault those. But what Elmer does, he changes them around to suit his purposes, and he's always impressing people who are in his sermons, and even the clergy sitting behind him at his ordination when he's giving this, they say, haven't I heard that before? And they're not quite sure, they're sure that Elmer couldn't have come up with that because he got C's and C minuses and D pluses in that kind of thing in their classes. But it's good enough, and they clap applaudingly, and Elmer is indeed ordained, and they do it with fear and trembling because they know that Elmer has been drinking beer and getting in fights and smoking when he's not supposed to, and they think, my gosh, this guy's going to be an ordained minister from our seminary. So they take a deep breath, and he's ordained, but they do it with some fear and trembling because they know Elmer. And the rest of the students can't believe that Elmer's going through with it, that he's really going to become a minister because they really know Elmer. And the one who really knows Elmer best, maybe Elmer, has no doubts about it at all. Straight ahead. He says, that's the game for me, he says. Preaching all those poor hicks on Sunday, and I'll make them cough up money. He says, oh, then I can go fishing on Tuesday the rest of the week. He says, that's the game for me. And it is indeed. He develops as he goes along, of course, some stock phrases that he hands out, some jargon. And this is just before he's ordained by the side of the river. And a former friend of his, Harry Zents, comes up. And Harry Zents and Elmer were hellraisers together at one time. And now Elmer, of course, is lording it over poor Harry because Elmer's wearing his new black broadcloth suit and his black shoes. And he's standing very straight with his white shirt on next to his mother, who's very proud. And he looks at Harry and calls him brother, which aggravates the heck out of Harry, because Harry knows Elmer. His brother, I am willing to help you find religion. And he slaps him on the back and about knocks him down. My whole life is a testimonial to my faith. And then Harry is, you know, giving him the eye. Are you Elmer? To the inner eye, there is no trouble in comprehending the threefold nature of divinity. We don't want any long-faced Christians in this church. The fellow that's been washed in the blood of the Lamb is just so happy. He goes around singing and hollering hallelujah all day long. And come on now, all get together and let's make this the biggest collection this church has ever seen. These are all his stock phrases that Harry is listening to. He could explain foreordination thoroughly, and he used the words baptizo and Athanasian. And all the people, of course, what does that mean? Baptizo and Athanasian. And those kinds of phrases made him a preacher before he ever was a preacher. If you have the jargon, you can get by with almost anything. And there they are by the river. And he and another fellow were being ordained. And they were asked the questions like confirmands are asked questions by the minister or by the deacons or elders. Dr. Engel commanded them to be faithful in the church. And he commended study, light meals, and helping the sick. I don't know what the light meals is supposed to do to make you a good preacher. Interestingly enough, that's exactly the advice that Bovary did when we operated on Hippolyta in Madame Bovary, and he was operating on Hippolyta's club foot, and he cut the Achilles tendon and crippled him for life and put his foot in a box, and the leg got gangrene, and they eventually had to cut it off and fit him in an artificial limb. But while he was moaning and groaning in this artificial box, and Charles Bovary, he was a klutz of a doctor, didn't know anything about a doctor. He advised light meals, as if that's going to help the soul as well as the foot. Well, here we are at the river. Everyone joined in a tremendous basket lunch on long plank tables by the cool river. Banana layer cake, donuts, fried chicken, chocolate layer cake, scalloped potatoes, hermit cookies, coconut layer cake, pickled tomato preserves on plates which skidded about the table, with coffee poured into saucerless cups from a vast tin pot, inevitably scalding at least one child who howled. There were hearty shouts of, "Pass the lemon pie, Sister Skiff," and "That was a fine discord of Brother Ingalls," and "Oh dear, I dropped my spoon and an ant got on it. Well, I'll just wipe it on my apron." That was fine, the way Brother Gantry explained how the Baptist Church had existed ever since Bible days. Boys bathing, shrieking, splashing one another, boys getting into the poison ivy, boys becoming so infected with the poison ivy that they would turn spotty and begin to swell within 7 hours. Dr. Engel enthusiastically telling the other clergy of his trip to the Holy Land, Elmer lying about his fondness for the faculty on the theological seminary. And that's the Sunday afternoon when he was installed. Sounds kind of nice, doesn't it? You bet. If you can just ignore the fact that Elmer's there, and Elmer's got other plans. Well, he goes to his first, they send him to his first little parish down in Kansas, and he meets Sister Baines, Lulu. And he says Lulu is soft as a kitten with some nice round eyes. And Lulu is the daughter of one of the deacons, and Elmer has designs on her right off the bat. And it isn't long before, and he comes down and goes back up by hand car. He goes from the seminary on the rail by hand car down to this town, 12 miles, and he has to pump it back, and that's the way he gets there. After he meets Lulu, he begins spending weekends there. And they have a little room off the barn. And one night, he and Lulu are in each other's arms. And she says, "Oh, when are we going to get married?" And, of course, this question had never occurred to Elmer. He says, "Married? Married? Well," he says, "I've got to get established, of course, naturally, and finish the seminary and get myself a real church." He's backing away. And she's got those big eyes, "Oh, Elmer, Elmer." And then he goes back on the handcar pretty fast and says, "How am I going to get out of this?" And he's always plotting one step ahead of somebody with a shotgun. And he's sitting in his room, and all of a sudden the door is kicked open, and there stands Lulu's father with a shotgun and says, "You're going to point your nose back to our church, and you're going to do right by my daughter." He's found, I guess Lulu has confessed all or something. And Elmer is so quick of tongue that he makes up some beautiful story about how he was a blessing to this poor, friendless girl, and he tried his best to counsel with her, and on. But the father's hearing none of this, and down they go, and they're going to have a big wedding. Well, Lulu's boyfriend, up to before she met Elmer, was Floyd. Now, Floyd is a wonder. He's not much up here, but he's strong of back, and he can hoe and plow and all that. And he can't figure out why Lulu should have fallen for Elmer anyway. So Elmer plots to get the two back together. And little by little, he gets them out in the woods under some pretext, and then he leaves. And Floyd just grabs Lulu and says, "Oh, Lulu, I can't let you make this horrible mistake to marry this phony preacher," because he didn't like Elmer, obviously. And then Elmer leaves and goes, gets Mr. Baines, says, "Mr. Baines, I want you to see what's going on out here in the woods." And I forgot, if I can find this, pardon me, I need a shot of brandy. I said that last week, and one of the guests went upstairs and brought down some brandy. Oh, it was at night, so it made it all right.
Situation.
Yes.
Yeah. Situation.
Yes, yes. Okay, if I can find this. Well, I mean, for your stomach's sake and for my throat.
That was wine.
Well, yes. Oh, I've got to find this place here. It's my book says 150, and there's nothing on 150. Let's see, 117 maybe.
Did you do that after you had the brandy or before?
What? Missed the place? I just laid it down. Oh, anyway, here he is. He says, "Deacon Baines, I want you to come with me and see something terrible." And he says, "Put down your lantern. I've got one of those electric dinguses here." He had brought it just for this purpose. He also had a revolver in his pocket. When Elmer and the bewildered Mr. Baines burst upon them, saw them in the circle with the electric flashlight, Lulu and Floyd were deep in a devastating kiss. "There!" bellowed the outraged Elmer. "Now you see why I hesitated to be engaged to that woman. I've suspected all along. Oh, abomination, abomination. And she that committeth it shall be cut off." Floyd sprang up, a fighting hound. Elmer could doubtless have handled him, but it was Deacon Baines who, with one maniac blow, knocked Floyd down. The deacon turned to Elmer then, the first tears he had known since boyhood. "Forgive me and mine, brother. We have sinned against you. This woman shall suffer for it always. She'll never enter my house again. She'll, by God, marry Floyd. And he's the shiftless damn fool farmer in 10 counties. "I'm going," says Elmer. "I can't stand this. I'll send you another preacher. I'll never see any of you again." "I don't blame you. Try to forgive us, brother." The deacon was sobbing now. Dusty, painful sobbing. Bewildered sobs of anger. The last thing Elmer saw in the light of his electric torch was Lulu huddled with shrunk shoulders, her face insane with fear. And off Elmer goes, wiping his hands clean, shoulders back, singing his hymn. And he got out of that one. Well, the hierarchy back at the seminary, Mitzpah Theological Seminary, they're not blind, yes. And they know about, they've heard about this. Oh, I ought to give you a touch of this description of this church, if I can, the seminary. What Sinclair Lewis does of this. It's really beautiful. I was thinking about having somebody sit up here and find these for me as I would save time, but I forgot to ask him to do that. Well, I'll save that for next time. So he goes, he gets another church, and he's immediately on the train to this other church, and he meets Trump's traveling salesman, and they offer him a drink, and he says, "Can't drink, boys." And he says, "Well, come on, be a good old boy." And they slap him on the back. He says, "Well, maybe just one." And that one leads him to several, and he gets off the train with the salesman, and before you know it, he's singing the old songs and slapping on the back, and they're calling him by their first name and telling dirty jokes, and he misses the first sermon he's supposed to give at this new church. And he wakes up with a hangover and says, "Oh, I've got to call the president of the seminary and work this out." And he walks into the office fully confident of his powers. And the president is waiting for him with a steel gaze in his eyes. And he just chews Elmer out up one side down and says, "You're fired from the seminary. You're already ordained. We can't do anything about that. I wish we could." But he had to come. He had been ordained. He had to come back and finish his last year, you see. "But you're out. Take off." He says, "If I ever hear you preaching in a Baptist church again, I'll have you run out of town and rail." So that ends the first section of the book. And Elmer is out of a job. But not for long. Because Elmer is an enterprising young man, and he meets Sharon Falconer. He starts, he puts out little ads in the paper that by a few sessions he can make you a better person, how to win friends and influence people kind of thing. And he runs into the Sharon Falconer. He sees her and her troupe, piano player and a bass player and a guitarist and a few other people. And he's immediately spellbound by her. And he says, "I've got to meet that woman." And that's the beginning of the second section. He goes to one of her revivals. There was a pause. Everyone waited, a little uneasy. Their eyes went to the top platform. Elmer gasped. Coming from some refuge behind the platform, coming slowly, her beautiful arms outstretched to them, appeared a saint. She was young. Sharon Falconer, surely not 30. Stately, slender, and tall. And in her long, slim face, her black eyes, her splendor of black hair was rapture or boiling passion. The sleeves of her straight white robe with its ruby girdle were slashed and fell away from her arms as she drew everyone to her. "God," prayed Elmer Gantry. And that instant, his planless life took on plan and resolute purpose. He was going to have Sharon Falconer. Her voice was warm, a little husky, desperately alive. And she preaches this beautiful sermon. And she has a tremendous magnetic appeal. And Elmer tries to worm his way into her troupe and succeeds. says that he could be an aid and an asset to her because he's done a little preaching in his time. And she's very indifferent to him, which just drives him at the wall. He's not used to having women being indifferent, and so she just kind of treats him coolly. But she likes him, but she's kind of stringing him along. Until finally he does join the troop, and he sees that somebody else gets fired so he can take his place as kind of a PR front man. And they go from town to town setting up this big tent and doing the revival thing. And she gets into the healing thing, and she heals a few people, and her reputation spreads, and her troop grows until she has probably 20 or 30 people on a payroll. And they just kind of go through one town after another. Elmer Gantry preaches booming sermons, but the highlight is always Sharon Falconer. And she's a beautiful person, a very enigmatic person, until finally she does fall in love, a type of love, with Elmer, and that she becomes the second great influence. And she finally starts believing her own press notices that she does heal and all this kind of thing, and she makes thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, and she decides to buy a pier in New Jersey, on the New Jersey coast, an old fishing pier with this little, you know, building on the end of it, and that's going to be her temple. And they put all the money they've got into this temple, and they have the grand opening. And those of you remember what happens from the movie, there's some workmen outside, and it's full of banners and streamers, and it's old wooden pier, and the workmen have just finished painting it, and they're standing outside, and there's a lot of paint rags and buckets of paint around. And just as she starts painting, the workmen say, "Well, hell, I can't listen to this preaching, let's get out of here." And they take one last drag of the cigarette, snap it away, and right in the bucket of paint it goes, and some rags, and the fire starts while she's preaching. And I think that's probably worth me reading a little bit to you. What Elmer does in that situation. It's rather typical Elmer. A third of the way back, coming through one of the doors opening on the promenade, was a curl of smoke. Elmer startled. He almost rose. He feared to rouse a panic and sat with his brain a welter of terrified jelly till he heard the scream, "Fire! Fire!" and saw the whole audience in the choir leaping up, screaming, 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 while the flimsy door jamb was alight and the flame rose fan-like toward the rafters. Only Sharon Falconer was in his mind. Sharon was standing like an ivory column against the terror. He rushed toward her. He could hear her wailing, "Don't be afraid, go out slowly." She turned toward the choir as with wild white robes they charged down the bank of seats. She clamored, "Don't be afraid, we're in the temple of the Lord. He won't harm you. I believe. Have faith. I'll lead you safely through the flames." But they ignored her, streamed past her, thrusting her aside. Elmer seized her arm. "Come here, Shara. The door at the back. We'll jump over and swim ashore." She seemed not to hear him. She thrust his hand away and went on demanding, her voice furious with mad sincerity, "Who will trust the Lord God of hosts? Now we'll try our faith. Who will follow me?" Since two-thirds of the auditorium was to be to the shoreward side of the fire, and since the wide doors of the promenade were many, most of the audience were getting safely out, save for a child crushed, a woman fainting and trampled. But toward the stage, the flames, driven by the sea wind, were beating up through the rafters. Most of the choir and the audience down front had escaped, but all who were now at the back were cut off. He grasped Sharon's arm again, in a voice abject with fear. "Pardon me, anybody got that brandy?" He shouted, "For God's sake, beat it, we can't wait." She had an insane strength. She thrust him away so sharply that he fell against a chair, bruising his knee. Furious with pain, senseless with fear, he raged, "You can go to hell," and galloped off, pushing aside the last of the hysterical choir. He looked back and saw her, quite alone, holding up the white wooden cross which had stood by the pulpit, marching steadily forward, a tall figure pale against the screen of flames. All of the choir who had got away remembered or guessed the small door at the back, as did Adelbert and Art Nichols, and all of them were jamming toward it. The door opened inward, only it did not open, with a score of victims thrust against it. In howling panic, Elmer sprang among them, knocked them aside, struck down a girl who stood in his way, yanked open the door, and got through it, the last, the only one to get through it. He never remembered leaping, but he found himself in the surf, desperately swimming toward shore, horribly cold, horribly bound by heavy clothes. He humped out of his coat. In the inside pocket was Lily Anderson's address as she had given it to him before going that morning. The sea by night, though it was glaring now with flames from above, seemed infinite in its black sightlessness. The waves thrust him among the piles. Their mossy slime was like the feel of serpents to his frantic hands. and the barnacles cut his palms. But he struggled out from beneath the pier, struggled toward shore, and as he swam and panted, more and more was the sea blood red about him. In blood he swam, blood that was icy cold and tumultuous and roaring in his ears. His knees struck sand, and he crawled ashore among a shrieking, torn, sea-soaked crowd. Many had leaped from the rail of the promenade or were still fighting the surf, wailing beaten. Their wet and corpse-like heads were seen clearly in the glare. The pier was only a skeleton, a cage round a boiling flame with dots of figures still dropping from the promenade. Elmer ran out a little into the surf and dragged in a woman who had already safely touched bottom. He had rescued at least 30 people who had already rescued themselves before the reporters got to him, and he had to stop and explain the cause of the fire, the cost of the tabernacle, the amount of the insurance, the size of the audience, the number of souls revived by Miss Falconer during all the campaigns, and the fact that he had been saving both Miss Falconer and Albert Shoup when they had been crushed by a falling rafter. 111 people died that night, including all of the gospel crew, save Elmer. It was Elmer himself who at dawn found Sharon's body lying on a floor beam. There were rags of white satin clinging to it, and in her charred hand was still the charred cross. That's the end of that section, immediate section. Though to the commonplace and unspeculative eye, Mrs. Evans Riddle was but a female blacksmith, yet Mrs. Riddle and her followers knew in a bland, smirking way that she was instituting an era in which sickness, poverty, and folly would be endured forever. She was the proprietor of Victory Thought Power Headquarters, New York. And not even in Los Angeles was there a more important center of the predigested philosophy and pansy-painted ethics. She maintained a magazine filled with such starry thoughts as, "All the world's a road whereon we are but fellow wayfarers." She held morning and vesper services on Sunday at Utopian Hall on 87th Street, and between moments of silent thought, she boxed with the inexplicable. She taught or farmed out classes in consecration, prosperity, love, metaphysics, oriental mysticism, and the fourth dimension. She instructed small, select circles how to keep one's husband, how to understand Sanskrit philosophy without understanding either Sanskrit or philosophy, and how to become slim without giving up pastry. She healed all the diseases in the medical dictionary and some which were not. And in personal consultations at $10 the half hour, she explained to unappetizing elderly ladies how they might rouse passion in a football hero. She had a staff, including a real Hindu Swami. Anyway, he was a real Hindu, but she was looking for a first assistant. And guess who the first assistant is? Elmer Gantry meets Mrs. Riddle. And immediately they strike up a great, great thing, and Elmer becomes very successful in this. He puts ads in the newspaper like this. "The world owes you $1 million. Why don't you collect it? What brought millions to Rockefeller, Morgan, Carnegie? Willpower. It's within you. Learn to develop it. You can. The world-mastering secrets of the Rosicrucians and Hindu sages revealed in 12 lessons by the renowned psychologist Elmer Gantry, PhD, DD, PSD, whatever that is. Write or phone for free personal consultations. The Bowers Hotel, Maine and Sycamore." Elmer's students were school teachers who wanted to own tea rooms, clerks who wanted to be newspapermen who wanted to be real estate dealers who wanted to be bishops, and widows who wanted to earn money with lots of elegance. He lectured to them in the most beautiful language, all out of Mrs. Riddle's magazine. He had a number of phrases, all stolen, and he made his disciples repeat them in chorus in the manner of all religions. Among the more powerful incantations were, "I can be whatever I want to be. I turn my opened eyes on myself and possess whatever I desire. I am God's child. God created all good things, including wealth, and I will to inherit it. I am resolute. Oh, I am utterly resolute. I fear no man, whether in offices or elsewhere. Power is in me, encompassing you to my demands. Hold fast, O subconscious, the thought of prosperity. In the divine book of achievements, my name is written in gold. I am thus the world's nobility, and now, this moment, I take possession of my kingdom. I am part of universal mind, and thus I summon to me my rightful universal power. Daily my subconscious shall tell me not to be content and go on working for somebody else." These are the things the students will talk back and forth. And after they go out feeling good and hot, and he's collected the $5 apiece, he says, "The poor saps." And he goes off with Mrs. Riddle, and they have a fine time. But this doesn't last long, and he eventually runs out of students. And he's in there mailing some ads in a post office one day, and he runs, and a little man next to him says, "Are you the Reverend Dr. Elmer Gantry, Ph.D., D.D., Ph.S.D.?" And Elmer looks at this guy and says, "Well, this poor sap hasn't got $5, and so he's not going to." He says, "Yes, I'm Elmer Gantry, Ph.D." He says, "Oh, I am Bishop so-and-so of the First Avenue Methodist Church." Oh, Elmer turns, and his face lights up, and he says, "Is that right?" And you can just see him devouring, opening his mouth and devouring the bishop. And his first line is, "I've always wondered if the Methodist Church could use a good Baptist preacher." And the bishop invites him over to Sunday dinner, and he bows low and kisses the hand of Mrs. Bishop, and she's all a flutter. And the bishop begins to show him his slides from the Holy Land, the tune he took, and Elmer just has more charm, you know, than a dog has fleas. And before you know it, the Methodist Church is opening its portals for Elmer Gantry. And Elmer determines to turn over a new leaf and be a good Christian, and he says, "Well, I'll even make bishop one of these days." There's just nothing that Elmer can't do, you see. He becomes a Methodist minister, and they take him in, and he has to undergo a little asking of questions by the guys, but he passes that. And he goes to his first church, and he meets the choir director, Cleo Benham. And Cleo begins the third section of the book, and his first impression is, of course, "I've got to have Cleo." And he does. And he introduces evening services on Sunday, and they do different things. He has them sing Dixie, and the people sing Dixie. "We're going to sing Dixie in church." And he stands up and says, "I want you to sing it better than the Hard Shell Baptists, better than the Presbyterians. Presbyterians wouldn't be caught dead singing Dixie, but we're Methodists, and Methodists can do anything." And they start singing Dixie. And he brings harmonica players. And one time he brought in a ukulele champion that had been passing through the state, and he has him play. And one time he brought in a wrecked automobile and set it right on the chancel and says, "This is what happens when you sin, when you go too fast, the people in here were drinking." And he brings in the reporters to take pictures of him standing next to this wrecked car. And the next morning there's Elmer Gantry with a wrecked car, and even got the pictures from the morgue of the dead people in there on the photograph. And just, he'll do anything to get notoriety, and the people love it. And the church grows, and all the other churches are saying, "How come that church is growing? What's this guy Gantry doing?" So the other preachers will start coming to the services, and they can't believe it. He's singing Dixieland, he's beating on a bass drum, and the ukulele player's going, and he's got cars. Anything for an object lesson. And the people love it. And the church grows, and he gets more money and more money, until finally somebody's coming around from a big university asking if his church will support this university, the Methodist College. Elmer's looking at him over the table and says, "Well, I don't know, Brother So-and-so. We've got our own things to do. We've got our own programs now going. And we can't be siphoning off this money for the kingdom, for this college." And the guy says, "Well, I don't know. Just last month we gave an honorary doctorate to somebody down in the other state, and they gave us some money." And Elmer says, "Well, now I've been offered several honorary doctorates, and I've turned them down," which is a lie. He says, "But I must admit some of my deacons would be mightily pleased if they could really honestly call me Dr. Gantry. But I'd probably refuse it even if you offered." And the president of the college says, "Well, now, you won't believe this, but the very reason I'm here today is to offer you an honorary doctorate." And they both smile without winking at each other. So the next thing, he is really Dr. Elmer Gantry, and he did indeed give some money to the college. And I guess that's the way things are done very often. I know that's the way CLC does it. Can I say this? Yes, I can and will. Not only do we give doctorates for that kind of purpose, we also give doctorates to the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, who is now Dr. Tex Landry. I mean, Dr. Tex Schramm.
Yeah.
And Dr. Texas Schramm, and also the coach of the Dallas Cowboys, is now Dr. Tom Landry. You bet. The fact that they use CLC's campus as a training ground in the summer has nothing to do with it, I'm sure. But it's very nice. Well, but I better not leave it there. because some of you may be from that area or love the Dallas Cowboys, but it just so happens that Tex Schramm and Tom Landry are nice guys, so it's all right to call them doctor. I mean, if they weren't nice guys, I'd really be sarcastic about it, but I didn't say that. Well, he starts reading. He figures he better read and make himself literate so he can drop in a few other things in his sermon. He had heard a lot about a poet named Browning. He had heard that he was a stylish poet and an inspiring thinker, but personally he did not find that he cared so much for Browning. There were so many lines that he had to read three or four times before they made sense, and there was so much stuff about Italy and all those other WAP countries. So that's the end of... So he and Cleo are finally married. He has to just figure this is it. This is the woman that will make him a bishop, because she's a nice woman. They're on their honeymoon. The bellboy had scarcely closed the door of their room with his double bed when he seized her, tore off her overcoat with a snow-wet collar, hurled at the floor. He kissed her throat. When he had loosened his clasp, she retreated, the back of her hand fearfully at her lips, her voice terrified as she begged, "Oh, don't, not now, I'm afraid." "That's damn nonsense," he raged, stalking her as she backed away. "Oh, no, please. Say, what the devil do you think marriage is?" "Oh, I've never heard you curse before, Elmer." "My God, I wouldn't. If you didn't act so as I'd try the patience of a saint or a monument." He controlled himself. Now, I'm sorry. Guess I'm kind of tired, too. There, little girl. Didn't mean to scare you. Excuse me. Just showed I was crazy in love with you, don't you see?" To his broad and apostolic smirk, she responded with a weak smile, and he seized her again, laid his thick hand on her breast. Between his long embraces, though his anger at her limpness was growing, he sought to encourage her by shouting, "Come on now, Cleo, show some spunk." She did not forbid him again. She was merely a pale acquiescence, pale save when she flushed unhappily as he made fun of her old-fashioned long-sleeved nightgown, which she timidly put on in the indifferent privacy of the bathroom. "Gee, you might as well wear a gunny sack," he roared, holding out his arms. She tried to look confident as she slowly moved toward him. She did not succeed. "Fellow ought to be brutal, for her own sake," he told himself and seized her shoulders. When he awoke beside her and found her crying, he really did have to speak up to her. "You look here now. The fact that you're a preacher's wife doesn't keep you from being human. You're a fine one to teach brats in Sunday school," he said, and many other strong-spirited things, while she wept, her hair disordered round her meek face, which he hated. So there's the beginning of the happy marriage. And, of course, he does marriage seminars on Sunday evenings, and notices on the first seminar that the church typist, the secretary, is a very cute and fluffy young thing. And that begins another little thing on the side. Then he puts in the bulletin, church bulletin, "Wake up, Mr. Devil. If old Satan were as lazy as some would-be Christians in this burg, we'd all be safe. But he isn't. Come out next Sunday, 10:30 a.m., and hear a red-blooded sermon by Reverend Gantry on Would Jesus Play Poker? And such things." And then he gets into politics a little bit. Finds out that's the way to make the thing grow even more. He says, "That's my game, politics, and prohibition is big." So he gets on the prohibition bandwagon, and there's a beautiful section here I won't have to take time to read. Some three or four old German guys are sitting in a saloon, minding their own business, talking about the old country, having a mug of beer, and Elmer has gathered all the reporters in town around him, and some of his parishioners, and they light torches, and they march down the street beating the drums, singing, "Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?" And he's got the big axe. He says, "The preacher's got to show the way." And he knows this tavern is here, and he knows these three or four old guys, and he knows they're not harming anybody. And he takes that axe and beats in the door, and they would have opened it. He just walked. It wasn't even locked. You know, go in and have a drink. And he stands up on top of the bar and starts smashing all the things, and the poor old Germans saying, "What are you doing to the beer?" And he immediately grabs one by the collar and cuffs him around and says, "How dare you speak to the servant of the Lord that way?" And he says, and says to the photographers, "Take a picture of this." And the next morning it's all over the papers, and Elmer Gantry's become a hero again. See? Now he's got all those people behind him. So he goes through episode after episode about like this. He almost meets his match toward the end of the book when Hetty, one of the gals he's been fooling around with, invites him up to her rooms, and all of a sudden in comes the husband, the outraged husband, with a camera taking pictures. And they confront Elmer with these pictures. Come to find out they're a con game. This guy and this gal make a living doing this to big boobs like Elmer Gantry. Poor Elmer doesn't know what to do. They got the goods on him. Well, one of his friends owns one of the newspapers, and he confides in this guy. And the guy likes Elmer anyway because he's a hellraiser, and he likes Elmer because he's a hellraiser. He says, "Don't worry, Elmer. He hired a private detective and went into the background of these people, found out they were wanted in 6 counties and 2 or 3 states. So when they come to the church to make their deal and really soak Elmer, they're ready for him, and Elmer wins again. He pouts out his chest and starts philosophizing and sermonizing. And the girl, Hetty, can't believe he's got this much cheek. She says, "Look, you remember? This is you. See, this is me. Remember that?" And then his friend nails him. "I know you're wanted here and you're wanted there, and I'll take the photographs." And they tear him up and they back off, and Elmer comes out clean again. And he, in his last, and of course the congregation knows about this, they've even seen the pictures. And somehow or other, Elmer manages to say he was there counseling the poor woman, and that he was down on his knees with her. And who are you going to believe? You know, the press or me? And so the book ends in this way, and he knows he's almost had it. And poor Cleo is sleeping in another bedroom. But he comes out to preach his first sermon after this great almost tragedy, and he walks out into the out of his office, and the auditorium stands up and cheers. Without planning it, Elmer knelt on the platform, holding his hands out to them, sobbing. And with them, they all knelt and sobbed and prayed, while outside the locked glass door of the church, seeing the mob kneel within, hundreds knelt on the steps of the church and on the sidewalk, and all down the block they knelt and sobbed. "Oh, my friends," cried Elmer, "do you believe in my innocence, in the fiendishness of my accusers? Reassure me with a hallelujah." And the church thundered with a triumphant hallelujah, and in a sacred silence, Elmer prayed, "O Lord, thou hast stooped from thy mighty throne and rescued thy servant from the assault of the mercenaries of Satan. Mostly we thank thee because thus we can go on doing thy work and thine alone. Not less, but more zealously shall we seek utter purity and the prayer life and rejoice in freedom from all temptations." He turned to include the choir, and for the first time he saw that there was a new singer, a girl with a charming ankles and lively eyes, with whom he would certainly have to become well acquainted. But the thought was so swift that it did not interrupt the pen of his prayer. "Let me count this day, Lord, as the beginning of a new and more vigorous life, as the beginning of a crusade for complete morality and the domination of the Christian church through all the land. Dear Lord, thy work is but begun. We shall yet make these United States a moral nation." And that, dear friends, is the end of the book. And thanks for coming.